This is Floss Weekly. I'm Doc Searles. This week, Catherine Druckman and I talk with Dan Lorenz, who is the co-creator of SigStore, which is a new standard for signing, verifying, and protecting software, and the president and CEO of ChainGuard, which is a company that puts this to work, protecting the supply chain of open source software, which is massive, complicated, and really important. And that is coming up next.
Podcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
This is Floss Weekly, episode 712, recorded Wednesday, December 21st, 2022. Software Supply Chain Security. This episode of Floss Weekly is brought to you by Code Comments, an original podcast from Red Hat that lets you listen in on two experienced technologists as they describe their building process and what they've learned from their experiences. Search for Code Comments in your podcast player. Hello again, everybody, everywhere. I am Doc Searles, and this is Floss Weekly. I'm joined this week by Catherine Druckman, who will appear in a second. There she is.
Hello. In
Houston, Texas. And I'm here you're still there. And I'm in New York, where there is a deceptively positioned air conditioner, for those of you who can see me behind my head, which has been idle for a couple months. There's some Christmas lights next to it. This is not my usual place, but I don't have one right now. So how you doing, Catherine?
I am doing pretty well. Sorry, I was just looking at my dead plant. I am woefully underprepared for holidays, so that's a thing. But I'm really excited about this because I'm talking a lot about this topic lately. So this will be a good, I think I'll learn a lot, which is nice. It's always nice to come here and learn new things.
So and the topic being...
Oh, are we teasing it? Sorry.
You are more prepared than I am on this. So
okay, the topic being software supply chain security, which is, I think, on a lot of people's minds right now.
Excellent. So let's get into it. Our guest today is Dan Lorenz. He's the CEO and president of ChainGuard, among other things, an expert on software. Supply chain security. I think we don't often think about a supply chain. Anyway, welcome to the show, Dan. How you doing?
I'm good. Thanks. Thanks for having me.
You're in for an adventure today.
Yeah. And where are you on Earth at this point?
Good question. I'm just outside of Providence, Rhode Island.
Oh, good. Good. So we're all. In the center of the country in the east, we're preparing for a bad cold snap, supposedly.
Oh, it's going to get bad here.
But yeah, in Texas, it's going to get down to like 40.
No, it's actually going to be something like 16, which Houston is just not prepared
really?
For. Houston. And our pipes are not. We're going to have to turn the water off for a couple of days in our house. Like, we're just going to camp. And I'm hoping that my jasmine on the fence doesn't die completely.
No, Jasmine's not good for that. So Dan, tell us how you got to where you are in this adventure, and kind of frame it up for us to start off the show.
Sure. Yeah, thanks for having me today. So I started this company, ChainGuard, with a few others a little over a year ago. We got started back in October of last year. But before that, I was an engineer at Google for about 9 years, where I was doing a bunch of stuff from open source infrastructure security, developer tooling, and then kind of toward the end, the intersection of all of that stuff with open source and supply chain security. So I've been at this for a while. The topic's recently gotten very exciting with things like the attack on SolarWinds, the massive Log4Shell vulnerability last year, and tons of typo squatting attacks that we see on popular open source package managers each week. So it's been a fun journey, and we're doing a bunch of open source ourselves and products to help combat this across the industry.
Since you brought it up, I wondered if you could tell us what typo squatting attacks are.
Sure. There was actually just one yesterday that was all over the news today on SentinelOne, if you've heard of that company. But a typo squatting attack is kind of a social engineering-y style trick where an attacker, so there's a bunch of different ways to do typo squatting and a bunch of different places you can do it in. But in the context of open source and supply chain security, typically what will happen is somebody will take a popular company or a popular open source project and then change the name slightly, whether they put in a typo or something slightly more nefarious, like change an abbreviation or something like that, and then upload another version of that same package to something like PyPI or NPM or RubyGems. And that other version is pretty close to the original one, except it has some malicious code inside of it. So that's what happened yesterday with Sentinel-1. Somebody uploaded a package to PyPI pretending to be some kind of SDK or client library for Sentinel-1, but it actually had nothing to do with the company. And the end goal then is to trick people into downloading it, thinking it's the real version. And then at that point, your malicious code gets to do whatever it wants, whether it's steal passwords, mine bitcoins, or something even worse. Those happen pretty often, and there's very little you can do about it.
Yeah, the pretty often thing is the scary part these days. So, I have so many questions for you, actually. But one of my first one. So, how has the recent government attention, let's say, changed the landscape of the work that you do? Right, there was the executive order on cybersecurity that was last year. There is the open source security legislation that is sort of, you know, in progress, I guess, or no, maybe not in progress, but out there. so a lot of it, I think, focuses on open source security. So that's I guess, kind of part two of the question. So there seems to be maybe a hyper-focus. And I wonder, is that because people realize that basically all software is open source software now? I mean, not all, but a considerable chunk of it. I mean, how, you know, is there software that doesn't use any open source components anymore? So I just wonder if the scrutiny and, you know, over open source software, is that fair? Shouldn't it just be sort of, instead of the problem with open source software, maybe it's the problem with software? So those are two questions in there in a very...
Yeah, there's a lot to those two questions, too. So I think you started off by asking, you know, how is the government attention and legislation affecting the landscape? Yeah, I think typically if you ask a software engineer, especially an open source maintainer, if they want the government paying attention, that's a terrifying thought for most folks. But, really what these attacks over the last couple of years have proven, though, is that governments themselves are also at risk. They also use open source, and they have to start paying attention to this area. So it's a reality that folks are starting to learn to live with. You referred to the executive order from the Biden administration last May, something like that, on securing America's cybersecurity posture, digital infrastructure, all that fun stuff, of which open source and supply chain was a huge component. Folks get confused a lot when looking at these things. Like, you can't have an executive order that says, write secure code, be secure, do things securely. I wish it were that simple. But instead, these regulations work is, the way these regulations work is by kind of instructing other agencies to instruct other agencies to look into things and produce recommendations, and then other folks to start adopting and following those recommendations. So a lot of the fallout in the last year or so that we've seen from this was NIST, the standards making body inside of the U.S. government, put together a huge framework for how to develop software securely. So this is kind of that shift. Instead of the software itself having to be secure at the end, the actual development process for itself should be secure, because that's kind of how supply chains work. And if you're not doing that securely and you're building out unsecured laptops and using unsecured CI servers, then attackers can find those. So that's called the SSDF, or Secure Software Development Framework. And again, folks like NIST can't make people follow any of these. They just publish these specifications.
Right. So we're kind of at the final. It's also very long.
Yes. Yes.
Incredibly long.
Massive. They're massive. So we're kind of at the end game now, I think, of these regulations rolling out, where the final step in a lot of this process is that the government can exercise their power as the largest consumer of software in the world, or one of the largest buyers of software, to start requiring people that sell them software to follow these practices. That's typically how it works. And so we're right at that stage now with things like the NDAA, or National Defense Authorization Act, that just got passed last week, which includes a bunch of regulations around cybersecurity, as well as the new omnibus bill, which is, I think, rolling out today, actually. Folks are trying to scramble through 4,500 pages of legislation, which is tied to funding. So it's been fast in terms of government time, I would say, you know, going from an executive order to this in like a year and a half. But it's, you know, feels pretty slow on the outside as folks are waiting for all of this to trickle around. The second half of that question, actually, do you want to jump in there before I go to the second half of your question around open source itself?
No. I mean, I did just want to say one thing about the length and the massiveness of these documents. I wonder if that's a bit of a deterrent, or it makes them less useful. I've wondered that. I read some interesting criticism, you know, online about that. And I would actually plug here the work of the OpenSSF in releasing some concise guides. But yeah, I wonder if you thought about that before you go into the open source part.
Yeah, the length is always fun. Nobody reads them, you know, in the actual,
that's
like, word for word and tries to follow it. But yeah, it ends up starting to get distilled down into scores and rubrics and frameworks and prescriptive guides. You mentioned the OpenSSF a couple times. So it's the Open Source Security Foundation, which is part of the Linux Foundation. And they've kind of been at the forefront of a lot of this work, even, you know, writing recommendations and participating in the process by which NIST came up with these recommendations. And so they have a couple different efforts going to help condense that into smaller prescriptive steps. One of those is the SALSA framework, or SLSA, which provides, you know, kind of boils it down to four levels 1 through 4, and it's very easy to see what you have to do to get your supply chain to level 1, to level 2, to level 3, to level 4, to hopefully save you time in not having to read hundreds and hundreds of boring pages of specifications. The open source angle, though, you mentioned is a really interesting one. You asked, you know, is there software out there that's not open source or doesn't use open source? All the stats I've seen say somewhere between like 90 and 98% of the code in most modern applications is open source. Yeah. Something like 98% of organizations surveyed say they're using it, and I think the other 2% got confused or clicked the wrong button or something like that when filling
exactly.
it out. It's impossible to not be using open source. And it's kind of like, I look at it as like the kind of tip of the iceberg analogy. The little proprietary part most people write themselves and don't release is just that tip of the iceberg, and you have this massive iceberg underneath, comprised of all of the open source code to get you up and running. And that all code has bugs. Open source code is no different. The more code you're using, the more bugs you're going to find, and some of those bugs have security implications. So that's where the kind of open source security angle comes from. You see vulnerabilities, you know, constantly. Stuff like Log4Shell last year was one of the biggest ones in recent memory for most folks. But not knowing what is under the water, not knowing what's kind of beyond the tip of the iceberg, is where folks are struggling today. You said, you know, it's not really an open source security problem. Maybe it's a software problem. I like to take that a little bit further, right? There's nothing bad about open source. Open source security is actually better than proprietary code security by pretty much every measure. The problem is in how organizations consume open source, though. So if you look at Log4Shell again as an example, it was fully patched by those maintainers within a week or two. You can say all you want about underfunding and understaffing and all of that, and we should do better, but they did their job within a week or two. And then you see stats last week on the anniversary of Log4Shell where 70% of organizations were still vulnerable to it. You know, that to me isn't an open source problem. That's a corporation, the way you're using open source problem.
That's a great point. Yeah, if you're not responding, if you're not taking these gifts that are thrown out into the public, if you're not accepting them, the fixes, then you're going to leave yourself open. That's a good point. So something that you mentioned in your intro, actually, I think you did anyway. I wanted to talk about identity and the concept of identity. Ooh. As it relates to signing software and trust. So could you talk about that a little bit? Why is identity verification so important to supply chain security?
Yeah, identity. That is a really deep topic. I know you both have a lot of background in. Identity is a little bit. I think identity is really tricky in open source in particular, but it's tricky, you know, for everything. But in open source, a lot of times folks don't know the identities of maintainers. They don't pay attention to any of this. You're just grabbing code off of the internet and picking it up and using it. There have been a lot of efforts to help improve that and help maintainers, you know, sign their code to make sure that when people grab it, they know they're getting it from the right source. This happens in companies quite often. You know, companies have corporate code signing certificates. Open source is a little bit behind there because the whole identity world is trickier. it's a really tough privacy question in open source, kind of the way I look at it. You might not necessarily care who the maintainer of a particular package is. You just want to know that it's that same person over time, or if it changes, that it changed on purpose and it wasn't one of these typo squatting or package repository or GitHub account takeover style attacks. And so there's a lot going on in that space to help folks, you know, maintain these kind of persistent identities, but without necessarily, you know, taking photocopies of their passports and uploading them to GitHub along with every single release of software.
Oh, I think Doc may have a question. Oh, he's muted.
I do, and I was on mute there for a second. Sorry.
I missed the chat there for a second.
I'm sitting here. Okay, so Dan, you know, I know there's a role that Sigstore plays in this. It's a standard for doing the work that you do. Tell us what your involvement with that is and how it relates to what you're doing with ChainGuard.
Sure. Yeah, so the Sigstore project is a set of open source projects and some infrastructure, which makes it a little unique, but I can get into that in a little bit. But the overall goal of all of this is to make code signing really, really easy and free for open source maintainers. If you're familiar with what Let's Encrypt did for TLS across the internet, that's kind of the same approach we're trying to take with Sigstore, except for code signing rather than TLS and HTTPS certificates. The infrastructure allows you to request these short-lived certificates that are only good for a couple minutes to use to sign your code. You authenticate yourself by logging into most common identity systems, so say Gmail or GitHub or GitLab or any of these other common identity providers, and you sign your code with that. So it might be an email address or a GitHub account or something else that is known to the users and contributors of that project. And by doing this, it's all free. You don't have to worry about keeping keys around like you might have had to before with PGP. You don't have to worry about losing them or anything. And anybody can get up and running with it in a couple of minutes. So this project got started a few years ago before we started the company back when I was at Google. And it's part of the OpenSSF today. So we're working on integrating it with most popular language package managers and ecosystems and tools in the container space, all across the CNCF, all that kind of fun stuff. At our company, we're using a lot of that tooling as well. So we have products and systems that help you start doing that inside of corporate environments, that same kind of open source technology that's free for PyPI and NPM. Need some tweaks to work behind firewalls and inside of enterprises. So we have a bunch of stuff in that space. So that kind of ties into the identity question we were talking about before.
Sorry about that. Boy, I'm writing mute at home. I have just have a button. I hold it down and it's muted. I pick it up and it's not muted here. I'm looking at the Zoom window. Sorry about that, folks. There's a term that I've heard more and more over the recent years around in the identity world, which is about provenance. And two questions about that. Is it provenance or provenance? And the other is, in the way open source works with code coming from so many places, they get put in containers and other things like this. How important or easy is it to keep on top of what the provenance of something is when really you're trying to guard what happens along the way? And maybe your work actually takes that off the table so customers aren't as worried about it. So just wanted to see if you can address that issue.
Sure. Yeah, you mentioned the magic provenance word. I've heard it pronounced a bunch of different ways, including like a common misconception there. People say Providence a lot, which is, you know, a city in Rhode Island near where I live. It has nothing to do with all of these. Provenance is kind of where, say, that piece of code came from. An example I like to use is, you know, most folks hopefully know that, here, let me grab one from my desk. Most folks know if you find a, you know, a USB thumb drive in the parking lot or sidewalk outside your work, you are not supposed to pick that up, bring it inside, and plug it into your computer. Hopefully most security folks have scared people away from doing that. But when you look at it, running pip install on some random package or NPM install on some random package isn't really that much different. You're still just kind of taking code from somebody you've never met. You have no real reason to trust them. Downloading it and then running it on your computer, or, you know, even worse, sticking it into a container and sending that into your production data center. So provenance and a lot of this tooling is kind of taking that concept and saying, well, why can't we plug in that USB thumbstick, look at the code in there, and then actually trace that back from that, you know, compiled binary back to the build system that it was built on, back to the commit in the Git repo that it was built from, back to the maintainer that wrote that commit. We don't really have those breadcrumbs today in a lot of these open source ecosystems. And cryptographic signatures and stuff like SigStore are a way to start building up that trail of breadcrumbs in a way that you can verify it later. We're not all the way there, but we're getting close, I think.
I actually have a question about SigStore, but first I have to let everybody know that this episode of Floss Weekly is brought to you by Code Comments, an original podcast from Red Hat. You know, when you're working on a project and you leave behind a small reminder in the code, a code comment to help others learn from your work, this podcast takes that idea by letting you listen in on two experienced technologists as they describe their building process. There's a lot of work required to bring a project from whiteboard to development, and none of us can do it alone. The host, Burr Sutter, is a Red Hatter and a lifelong developer advocate and a community organizer. In each episode, Burr sits down with experienced technologists from across the industry to trade stories and talk about what they've learned from their experiences. I subscribe to it, by the way. I really like the deep learning episode. It goes into how companies themselves, like Intel, actually use deep learning to help their process internally. It's good stuff. Episodes are available anywhere you listen to podcasts and at redhat.com/codecommentspodcast. That's all one word, Code Comments Podcast. Search for Code Comments in your podcast player. We'll also include a link in the show notes. My thanks to Code Comments for their support. So I'm looking at some notes here about, along with provenance, what's the difference between the way you're doing it with your work and the way it's done in the all or mostly proprietary world? Do you just leave it up to an Oracle, or you leave it up to one of those big guys to take care of the whole thing? Or are learnings moving back and forth between these two worlds, or are the worlds entirely no longer separate the way they once were?
Yeah. If you look at it and you look at the history of code signing, stuff like PGP has been around in open source for decades. And you've been able to use it in some large projects have, but it hasn't really seen widespread adoption. But if you look at, say, the proprietary worlds, you do kind of see these small circles or walled gardens that do have pretty good code signing set up. Some examples there are, say, like drivers for Windows. Microsoft requires those to be signed before they can be executed. Similar things for like the Apple App Store for phones or the Android Store for Android. But none of this was ever really set up general purpose. A lot of those concepts there around, like, is this signed? Yes, then it's safe to run. They're great for establishing some types of trust or barriers, but they leave a lot of problems unsolved. One great example there was, you know, the attack on SolarWinds we started by talking about. SolarWinds knew those certificates had been compromised as part of the attack, but the PKI, the infrastructure there for signing and the certificates made it so hard for them to revoke that certificate that it took them over a year to do so, because it would have kind of bricked or broken a bunch of installations that weren't compromised. And so there's a lot of improvements to be made across, you know, both open source and closed source, kind of these proprietary app store worlds. Provenance takes it a little bit further too, right? The typical code signing model that gets criticized a lot is, if it's signed, it's good. If it's not signed, it's bad. That whole concept of provenance you were talking about is more about attaching semantics. So you can sign something as it gets built, and you're not necessarily saying it's safe or not safe. You're just saying, hey, I built it on GitHub using this GitHub action. You're kind of stating and putting a bunch of facts on the record that somebody else can evaluate later. The only thing you're saying is that this statement is true. You're not saying it's good or bad or safe or unsafe. Does that make any sense?
Yeah, absolutely. I have a question. Go ahead, Catherine. Maybe others would be interested. We've talked a bit about SigStore. Can you kind of lay out for us what does it actually help prevent, and what are its limitations?
Sure. SigStore really, really is targeted just at that kind of authenticated metadata about software case. So it lets you make those claims. It lets you say, I with my email address, sign off on this saying it's a real release, or I built this using GitHub actions from this commit. It lets you put all these on the record. It lets people find them, and it's really great for that use case. I mentioned before that there's a bunch of open source projects with SigStore and also a bunch of infrastructure, which is a little bit unique. So a lot of projects just come with something you can download and run. SigStore has that, but it also comes with access to this free community-run public good infrastructure instance of SigStore that you can interact with. That contains a certificate authority you can get certificates from, as well as a bunch of transparency logs where this stuff gets stored and can be looked up from. These transparency logs are great because once you sign something, you can put it on the record. Anyone can find it. You can't really change it later or take it back. But the downside there, the big limitation is that everything is on this public record. So if you're trying to run some of this infrastructure internally or inside of your company, and you're building code that you might not be shipping, then you probably don't want to be putting every single build of your internal backend system on this public log where anybody can read it. Or you might not want to take a dependency on that service for something running inside of your data center. So there are different ways you can run parts of it inside or parts of it outside, but that's kind of the biggest limitation today. It's both a benefit and a drawback.
Okay. I wonder, could you also talk about the underlying software that powers SigStore? There are other pieces that fit into it, let's say Fulcio, Recore, that kind of things, and how all of these things fit together in the kind of to tighten up the software lifecycle.
Sure. Yeah. So I mentioned all those different components before. Those are some of their names. So the typical interaction model is somebody would download a client for SigStore. So depending on what type of stuff you're signing, if you're doing containers, you would download the cosign tool, it's called. If you're uploading a Python package, there's a special version of that for Python. Or if you're doing NPM, some of that stuff is getting baked into NPM directly. So once you have that tool for signing and verifying, you just run the commands, depending on how you're trying to sign your code. A browser window might pop open. You might click login with Google or login with Microsoft or something like that to get your identity. And then at that point, you get a certificate. So that certificate comes from the certificate authority, which is how this works for most other ecosystems too. And that's called Fulcio. So F-U-L-C-I-O, that's the name of the certificate authority piece. After you do all of that, the signatures, your SBOMs, the provenance, not the providence though, all that stuff gets signed and then stuck into the transparency log. So a transparency log is a kind of a append only database where you can add records and other folks can verify that records are in there, but you can't tamper with them later. You can't delete them. You can't change them after they're in that log. And that piece is called Recore, R-E-K-O-R. So there's a network of folks out there verifying that stuff only gets added to the log and doesn't, and nothing gets removed or modified. And then you as a user can check that log too and see a record of everything that you signed. So if all of a sudden something shows up in there that shouldn't be in there, you don't remember, say, doing a release of that package that day, then it's a pretty good sign somebody stole your identity somewhere. And you can use that as a hint or the start of a process to go and recover. So those are kind of the three components: a client, something like cosign, and then the certificate authority and the transparency log. But it's all set up in a way that's supposed to be developer friendly, and you don't even necessarily have to know about it beyond clicking that login button every once in a while when you release a package.
Developer friendly is an excellent phrase that we like to hear. I'm wondering, like, if I put myself in the shoes of a DevOps engineer, say, and I've let's assume I've spent a lot of time getting my pipeline to some near perfect level of efficiency in a perfect world. How do I add this to my setup in the absolute easiest way possible without completely moving my cheese?
Yeah, it depends kind of where that pipeline is, and everybody's got different systems for it. But that's really the magic, the secret sauce here. We're trying to get it to where you shouldn't have to do anything other than click a button saying you want to use this. And if you're using GitHub Actions or GitLab Runner or CircleCI or some of these popular build systems, then you're almost at that world today, which is great. The system should be transparent to you as a user, so it should be pretty easy to get set up, and you shouldn't have to think about it after that. I think we're sort of seeing a shift from everybody running their own Jenkins build systems on old Mac minis and closets to the people coalescing on a smaller number of more highly secured build systems like these. It's definitely a trade-off. There's a little bit of centralization happening, but overall, I think it's a net win for the industry, for folks to be relying on stuff that's more actively looked after.
That's good. I mean, easy to implement is the magic word there. What are the barriers to adoption? Are there?
the breadth of the space and the number of package managers and the number of build systems to integrate with. It's easier to bring on, say, every user of a packet of a language ecosystem at once by integrating directly into that tooling than having everyone do it themselves. So that's the approach that we're taking. Just time, though. The project's only been around a couple of years, and the adoption's kind
of
impressed everyone. Yeah.
It seems early, right? Early to talk about adoption quite yet, maybe. Although it seems to have some traction. There's a landscape page, right, where you can we love those landscape pages, don't we? you can kind of get a picture of who's using it and where, and it does have some nice traction, right?
Yeah, there's a landscape. I think it's a tab on the OpenSSF landscape that shows projects that integrate with it or use it to sign their releases or let you verify stuff on the other end. So there's a bunch of different categories for it and tons of projects. I think most notably stuff like the Kubernetes project itself, which releases dozens and dozens of containers and binaries and manifests for every single platform under the sun uses it now. They're one of the heaviest lifts that we've had to do today just because of the size of their releases and complexity.
So I was looking through your some of your white papers and projects and things, and you have these two products, Images and Enforce. Are they simultaneous for customers or sequential? How does what you sell work as people move into is become deeperly and more deeply involved as customers?
Sure. Yeah, I'll explain the products a little bit. Kind of the Images product is a set of container images that we build, and you can use those to either put your applications on top of, to use to build your applications in your development pipeline, or even some just kind of off-the-shelf apps that you can run in your infrastructure for web servers or frameworks or build systems, that kind of thing. Those images, we rebuild them constantly. We do all that salsa stuff with SBOMs and provenance and signatures. So when you use our stuff, you can trace it back to the GitHub commits and all of the code reviews and testing that was done for each of the builds. And then powering those, it's actually a really interesting new Linux distribution that we built called Wolfi, W-O-L-F-I. And so we built this Linux distribution to be optimized for these container environments. So there's stuff like no kernel in there, and the packages are all built declaratively inside of containers themselves, so that when you get one of these, it has the bare minimum number of dependencies, and we can keep the vulnerability scan results incredibly clean. Here's the little website. You can look up the SBOMs for each of the images, and if you scan them with your vulnerability scanner of choice, we should be down close to zero vulnerabilities on most days, which is a refreshing result compared to a lot of the other images out there where there are a lot more batteries included, have a lot more software, and it's not updated as frequently as ours. So that's kind of the start of the journey for a lot of folks.
there's the horn honking outside.
You've got a delivery right outside.
I know. I'm waiting for the buzzer to go off in the kitchen that says there's an Amazon guy at the front door. Somebody has to let him in, and it's not going to be me. I have some other business questions, but first, I need to let everybody know that about Club Twit. Club Twit is our own thing here at the Twit Network. Joining Club Twit is another great way to support our network. As a member, you get access to ad-free versions of all the shows on Twit, as well as other great benefits. There's a bonus Twit Plus feed, which includes footage and discussions that didn't make the final show edit, as well as bonus shows you started, such as Hands on Mac, Hands on Windows, and Ask Me Anything, and Fireside Chats with some of your favorite Twit guests and co-hosts. As Floss Weekly listeners, you may also be interested in checking out another Club Twit exclusive show, the Untitled Linux Show with our own Jonathan Bennett. It's a great show. You should go check that out. It's on weekends. So sign up to join Club Twit for just $7 a month. Head over to twit.tv/clubtwit and join today. We thank you for your support. I'm just thinking, I for provenance and provenance and provenance and providence, I wrote a book called The Intention Economy that was against the attention economy, and everybody calls it the attention economy because that's what they hear. So it's hard. Anyway, English is a tough language. I want to ask you about business model, which because you always have to ask that. Do you have a free version? Do you start people out? It's a subscription of some sort, but you know, you have big companies that you're serving, you have little companies. How does that all work?
Yeah. So the images themselves, all the code, all of that is open source, right? We're by building our own Linux distribution, we are rebuilding all of the packages, stuff like curl and OpenSSL and everything that you're familiar with. So all of that is open source. All of our distribution is open source. And we have a free tier of the images as well. So a lot of the images, we keep a free version that anyone can download. You don't have to sign up. You can just scan it or pull it. And those are at github.com/chainguard-images/images. It's the whole list of all of them. You can find them there. The paid version of all of that comes with multiple versions and older support and LTS and other stuff that folks need for compliance. So we support a bunch of open source projects that use these things for free, and then charge companies for enterprise features and support for older stuff that they typically need. Pretty simple overall.
So I actually have another question, and it's one of my annoying multi-part questions. I read a post you did, a retrospective, so to speak, on all the great things that have happened in open source security in 2022. And there are many, and please, feel free to speak about those. But I also wondered what you hope to see next year. Now that we're at the end of the year, it's a nice time to talk about these things. And what you hope to see. So that's part one. Part two, and what role do you expect to play in those things that you hope to see? And the third part is, how can the open source community, how can people like me or anybody listening get involved in making those things happen?
Sure. All right. So part one was,
what do you hope to see?
I hope to see. Yeah. What do I hope to see? And then how am I going to be a part? And then how can you be a part? Okay. So what do I hope to see? This year, 2022, this is definitely the year of the SBOM, I would say, the SBOM or Software Bill of Materials. That was kind of the centerpiece of most of the legislation, most of the government regulation that we've seen going around. And the whole idea with SBOM is that when you get a piece of software from someone, they should give you this standard format, machine readable document explaining all of the stuff in there, including all of the open source. So that way you can look for stuff like log4j, check the versions, scan all of the stuff inside for vulnerabilities, and stop treating software as like a black box. Mm. It's unfortunately a really hard topic. It's really complex. There's tons of different ways software is built and bundled together, and engineers love to bike shed about all of those little details and how to describe those relationships and how to name those components and all of that fun stuff. And so a lot of the conversation has just been around, what is an SBOM? How do we do them? Are they good? Do you have one? Do I have one? Do we need one? Does it secure me? That kind of stuff. So I hope next year is really the year that we can put them into action rather than just talking about them. It's way more than just binary too. Even if you have one, we just released some data today about a lot of the existing ones out there. They're incomplete. They're inconsistent. They're missing things. They're not even, in the correct standard format. So I think hopefully next year we can actually get SBOMs in action and then start talking about the quality of them and making sure that they have enough data to be useful. We're doing a bunch of work there. We're trying to, we're participating in the standards groups, updating the formats, and releasing those with all of our software for our customers as well. It's pretty easy to get involved. If you're not doing SBOMs, then try and then complain and file bugs and send fixes in for all the tooling to make it easy. Because like you said before, developer friendliness is going to be key here. And if, especially in open source, if people have to think about it, it's an extra step, then they're just not going to do it.
Yeah, I think you were spot on there. Mm-hmm. I think, developers, I think developers, I used to be one, tend to sort of hyper-focus. You're hyper-focused all the time, right, on your problem, whatever the problem of the day or the month or the quarter or the year is, and you're so focused on that, it's so hard to get a big picture of what you're working on. And I think, I'm very sympathetic with people presented with having to get on board with add another thing that you're responsible for and comply with and And but, you know, I also think it's important because who among us has not been in dependency hell? And I think the visibility that this will give you is going to be a lifesaver to many eventually. But maybe we could talk actually a little, since you brought up S-bombs, I think that's something we haven't
I said
about
the word.
Yeah. I know you said the word. So I wondered if you could talk just a little bit about, you know, let's say the current state and where we need to be with S-bombs, especially when you talk about things like U.S. government or other governments requiring S-bombs of certain vendors.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's kind of one of the big areas. We talked about some of the regulations at first and how the government's going to start requiring this as it purchases software from vendors. This is one of the things they're going to start asking for this year. So when they buy your software, they might ask you to provide an SBOM alongside of it. And so that's, you know, a list of all of the subcomponents inside of that software, down to, you know, all the transitive dependencies, the dependencies of those transitive dependencies, which is really hard to do for folks in the beginning. They serve a couple use cases. I think the biggest two, the easiest two to reason about, are number one, vulnerability management. So if you zoom back a year when Log4Shell happened, everyone had to spend their holidays emailing every single one of their vendors, asking them if their software used Log4Shell, and then how to remediate it if it did use that affected version of Log4j. SBOMs would let you skip that step hypothetically because they'd give you a list of everything inside and you wouldn't have to email them. You could just check those SBOMs to see if it's in there. We're jumping ahead to Vex. Vex is another awesome topic. Vex is kind of step two I see here to the SBOM movement. Once SBOMs do get widespread, if they do get widespread, folks are going to start seeing a lot more, right? It's a transparency conundrum. When you can start seeing how the sausage is made and you see all of the stuff in these software packages that you're using, the obvious next step is to start scanning all of that for vulnerabilities. And the whole software world is going to look much worse and much more insecure than it did, you know, before this transparency was introduced. Vex is kind of the complement there, where Vex is a way for vendors to say that, yeah, we looked at all of those vulnerabilities in the scanner and we determined they're not applicable in this case because we compiled with different flags or we don't call a function that's vulnerable or some reason like that. So they're kind of a way to automatically quiet the scanners or automatically annotate those results to help reduce the noise that's going to come from all this increased transparency. Is that enough? Did I answer it all?
Yeah, I did, and I was muting myself again and swearing I would never do it again, and I did it. We have an active IRC back channel here, and one question from there is how will you see customer inventorying and managing the life cycle of your certificates beyond signing certificates, what others are in a blind spot for customers? I probably didn't read that right, but... But there you go.
So the question is, how do we see folks managing the life cycle of certificates? The kind of shift I think that we're seeing, and this ties into a lot of the other federal buzzwords around zero trust. But I think the shift we're seeing is kind of a movement away from these really long-lived secrets or long-lived private keys or long-lived certificates that you have to keep private and keep access to for a really long period of time. And if they leak, then the damages are long-lasting as well. We're seeing a shift from that to much more shorter-lived, automatically rotating tokens and credentials and certificates that you can get on demand as part of, you know, similar to most of the zero trust infrastructure movement. So instead of just doing everything with a password or some long access key that can get leaked, you're doing it with stuff that's automatically retrieved on demand. That's the general trend, not just for code signing, but for everything like that, dealing with cryptographic material.
Yes, I was fishing for more questions in the back channel, which is busy talking to itself about everything else at the same time. So let me ask a different question, which is you spent a lot of time at Google, and I suspect it was at a fairly transitional time. This may relate in this interesting way. I've been around Silicon Valley for a long time, and I always thought there are like three stages for every company, which is new, hot, and then big, and they're almost completely different. But Google's been big for a long time, and I think there are probably a lot of learnings you got inside of their before you punched out to do your own thing. And I'm just wondering if you could give us some insights about what you learned there. And a separate question, I'll be a multi-part, like Catherine, what is the role of big platforms like Google and Amazon and Microsoft, for that matter, with Azure going forward? It seems to be we're sort of in an era of maximum big tech, and they're starting to move in another direction now, at least from the outside, it looks like that. But the change that you're concerned with are a little bit outside that concern, but I'm just wondering what's happening to big tech.
Oh, sure. Yeah. So transition, you said, what did you say? New, hot, and then big?
Yeah, new, hot, and big. Well, you get a startup and it gets hot. If it lives, it gets hot. And then you plateau, you're big now. And it's like a whole other thing. Very few companies manage those things the same way or with the same leaders or the same people. It's sort of there are sort of state changes that occur, like the stages of a rocket getting into orbit.
Yeah. So I think, you know, I was there for about 9 years. When I started there, it was 2012, 2013. And it felt big at that time. But, you know, I think like 10 times bigger by the time I left. So I don't know what phase it was in at either of those times. But I think, you know, this kind of ties into the rest of your question on what role do those big platforms play? You know, I think the biggest thing that I saw happening there that I think we're still seeing happen throughout the rest of the industry was, you know, what motivated a lot of the zero trust and what motivated a lot of this supply chain security work. It was, if you look back at what was happening in kind of that 2012, 2013 timeframe at Google and most of these other big companies, it was Operation Aurora, the kind of rise of the beginning of these nation state attacks, where persistent threats and really scary security folks were spending lots and lots of time trying to break into companies like Google. And that was a threat model that most companies weren't really considering at the time, like an actual nation trying to attack you. So that led to huge amounts of innovation and reinventing and rethinking of the way secure systems internally at these companies. Then kind of the rest of that decade, the rest of the 2010s, I think, you know, every big massive kind of hyperscaler company had to deal with that. But unless you were one of them, you probably didn't think about it at a 50 or 100 or, you know, even 500 or 1,000 person company. You didn't think or model that in your threat models. But now what we're starting to see is you know, what we saw with the SolarWinds attack and what we see with these other insider compromises happening across companies, across the industry, is that you don't have to be a hyperscaler to be in those crosshairs. If you're somebody that sells software to somebody that sells software to someone that is one of those hyperscalers, or say is the federal government, now you're just a couple hops in the supply chain away, and everyone is having to start to reckon with that in their threat models.
It's interesting that I'm thinking about, I'm kind of going back to what you said earlier about the SSDF, which is provided by NIST, which is a federal government institution, and how big a customer they are. And I'm wondering what, on the outside, I tend to think of the government as a slow mover, just by nature. I worked for a company once that was one of those that supplied $25,000 PCXTs to the federal government. When they have a big buy, they're going to buy, you know, 2 million PCs. They're going to be costing more than anybody's paying in the open market for these things. But I suspect that the federal government is being much more sophisticated now. And so I'm wondering what kind of pull they have and how that in a way drives the market from the demand side. I'm always interested in what the demand sides of markets do to pull better stuff out of suppliers back up a chain, which isn't always a chain because you're getting things, you know, containerized with five or six different locations at once. So it's more like a web, I guess, than a chain.
Yeah, it's complex. You know, I'm sure the federal government's a lot more advanced now than it was back then. There's definitely pockets. You know, there's really modern areas, and then there's, you know, areas that are still modernizing. They do have a lot of power, though, on that purchasing side. Like you said, as one of the largest vendors, when they buy something, they buy a lot of it. And they buy a lot of things across the board. Because of the way a lot of this stuff like the SSDF is written, it applies recursively, too. So if you're trying to comply with a lot of that stuff, you also have to require the same guarantees from your vendors. So it's kind of impossible to get started with, actually, because somebody has to do it first and they can't be compliant until everyone else is. But it will spread pretty fast across the web, just given the size and number of folks that sell software to the government.
Does anybody in the government write software? I'm just wondering if they are they, if I go into GitHub and I'm looking around for developers that are doing things, or, I mean, I know there are lots of them that are working for a lot of the big companies. We had Greg Kroll Hartman on here earlier, who's one of the alpha maintainers of Linux, who talked about all the big companies that, that Linux maintainers work for. Do any work for the government, or is, if they don't, just maybe they don't pay enough? I don't know. I have no idea.
Yeah, the government employs a lot of full-time software developers. They also do a lot through contracting. So there's a lot of custom software that gets written for the government, whether it's, you know, as a government employee or somebody contracted directly by the government.
Yeah. So, Catherine, you had something there?
Yeah, you know, I go back to every, you know, I go back to putting myself in the shoes of a developer who doesn't know nearly enough about security, which I think is maybe everybody, because security is a complicated topic and you can never, you know, we're always learning, right? So I'm wondering, you know, to kind of recap some things you said earlier, like what would be the next steps you would recommend for a developer who just needs to dig in and understand the risks of the software supply chain security? Where would you recommend those people turn for resources right now?
Good question. Yeah, there's a really good intro course from the OpenSSF, actually.
Yes.
I'm exactly sure how to find the link. But yeah, they do have a bunch of education materials and courses on how to get started, and not just the supply chain security aspects, but just things to think about and things to watch out for as you write your software to help reduce the introduction of security bugs. So yeah, it's a great course. I was able to review it before it was published and really like it and recommend it to lots of folks.
Yeah, that's actually a great one I was going to mention. The OpenSSF has done a lot of really great work, as you mentioned. I mean, as you mentioned in your post, you know, over the last year, especially, as an organization, they seem to have really built up a lot of steam. And maybe that's something you could talk about, too. I mean, so how did SigStore go from a project that you co-created to being part of the OpenSSF? What was that process?
Sure. Yeah. It's kind of cyclical, actually, because I was also working on getting the OpenSSF started kind of at the same time. The OpenSSF itself, it's pretty new as well. Was it the end of 2019, beginning of 2020, something like that, when it actually got started? So, you know, SigStore was kind of going on in parallel at the same time. And once the OpenSSF got going and got through the pandemic and all of those delays and everything like that, it was a natural home. So we were able to move it into the OpenSSF. About a year ago now, I can't remember exactly when that was done.
Yeah, that's great. It's a great reminder of, the nature of organizations like that, where you pitch in your solutions, and the best things kind of bubble up, and it's a good reminder to go to them for not only training but to get involved where possible. I think, Doc.
No, I'm just mindful of the time, because we're getting down toward the end of the show here. So let me ask you before we get to our final two kind of control questions or experiment control questions. Are there any questions we haven't asked you yet that you'd like to address?
I think we covered everything.
I don't think that ever happens. But we always think of things after the show's over. Well, let me get to the final two then, which are: what are your favorite text editor and scripting language?
Ooh, I don't really get to write much code anymore. But yeah, I'm a VS Code user when I do write code. And then scripting language, gotta say Bash.
Good answer.
Bash seems to be
a little, I love it when people say Bash.
Yeah, a lot of people say, I don't want to say it, but it's Bash. And it's, I don't know what's wrong with that. We had Brian Fox in here earlier. It was his favorite too, but he wrote it. So this has been great, Dan. We really loved having you on the show. And I apologize for being less prepared and situated as I would like to be, but I think it went well. Catherine's strong. She lives this stuff. So that always, that helps. Sorry for your run. So, and we'll have to have you back to talk more about this stuff after the world changes again in, the,
sure.
in 5 minutes. So Catherine, how was that for you, man?
That was great. You know, I enjoy, you know, people like Dan are people that I honestly look to. I look to his work and his peers. And those are the people that I like to learn from and, you know, and I'll honestly also spread the word because they're doing a lot of really important work. So I was very excited to be part of the conversation to begin with. So I still am, and I hope we can continue it. And I look forward to what he does next year.
Yeah. And I, you know, and I saw the topic, I thought, oh my gosh, this is an important topic. And I thought nothing about it.
Yeah,
yet.
It's good. It's important stuff. Yeah. So that's, it really is.
Yeah. I mean,
none of us want our software to be compromised. I mean, I think we learned some hard lessons over the last few years. And so that's why this conversation has really bubbled up, and it's like kind of in the forefront, or it is in my mind. I mean, I'm a little bit biased because I talk about this stuff a lot, but yeah, it's, but people are out there doing the work.
It. I mean, so. I'm living it now because my supplier.
Oh, your email.
My email hosting, yeah. You know, all yep. It's with Rackspace, and Rackspace is still down as far as I don't even check anymore. They're down, you know, the part of it. It's probably, I shouldn't say that. I don't know if they're actually down. I haven't checked in several days because I've just given it up. You know, but I mean,
you may never get it back. All that mail.
That back. Whatever was in there, maybe gone. Maybe being IMAP, I may have it here. I've been so busy with other things, I haven't looked. I kind of don't want to look to see if it's here. It's, but yeah. And that was an attack. They got attacked. And
it's a great example.
Something in their supply chain wasn't right. And,
right.
Sure.
There are so many. I mean, you know, it's like the more complicated software gets, I guess, the greater the attack surface, or, you know, number of the vulnerable spots. And that's why, you know, so many really smart people are scrambling right now to come up with solutions and again, putting in a lot of work and coming up with some good stuff. So the more we talk about it, the more work is done, all these things.
Yeah. I mean, the more variables, the more dependencies, the more the attack surface turns into a kind of four-dimensional polyhedron.
I think, like, we talked about this in an episode, I think, about the number of dependencies, you know, that your average piece of software has is just, you know, increased tremendously over time, and those, the all of those are opportunities for vulnerabilities, I suppose. And I don't know, in the way that we write software, where everything is sort of discrete and plugged in like a little tower of Legos, but you just yank a little Lego out and thing, right? It's it's complicated.
It's an XKCD cartoon in all dimensions.
Exactly. We love to cite that one. Although I'm a little bit cautious because I worry that it gives open source a bad name, but it is a good one. I think there's a misconception still that open source is something, you know, volunteers and hobbyists, which isn't necessarily true, but it is a good XKCD. So.
And I think a point Dan made early on, which is that 80, 90, 100, close to 100% is now open source.
Yeah, no, it's like, it's basically, that's software
kind of amazing.
Is open source software. That's just the way it's made. That's the way we make software.
Yeah.
So I get a little testy. You and I, having been around open source for so long and in the role that we were talking about it in ways, you know, evangelizing it, promoting it, you know, I'm like, well, and I hear the problem with open source software. I'm like, what? It's not open source. That's the problem. But yeah.
Right. So. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Wow. It's like the problem with lumber is trees, you know? Well, not really.
Yeah. The problem with air is that we have to breathe it.
Yeah. So, and let's get a plug in before we go.
Ah, plugs. Yes. Yeah. Always. What can we plug? We can plug the other podcast that we do. Actually, we came up with a really good one. Yeah, that was a good one. We had a really good one this week about ChatGPT. And I'm looking forward to a holiday break, though.
Yeah.
And I may have some other things to plug in the new year. I'll just be cryptic about that. You can follow me on Twitter. But actually, don't follow me on Twitter. I hate Twitter today. But follow me on Mastodon. Yeah, I can't. It's like It's like a, it comes naturally, like the muscle memory. I say Twitter and then I don't mean it.
I know.
Mastodon. I was thinking, follow me on Mastodon. Catherine D at Librem One.
I have a Twit one and I have a Journal one and I've had a number of, I haven't had fully figured out Mastodon yet, but it's starting to become more useful.
Oh, it's so great. This is good. It's so much more fun. All the open source nerds are there and it's a good time. And if you're curious about what I'm up to and what I might have to plug in the future, that's where to find me.
Well, that's great. And next week, I think we're off, but then we have a roundtable coming up after that. And a lot of good guests after that.
I think I'm on it.
More and more of them. So you're on it.
I guess I better show up that day.
Yeah, that's great. So until then, everybody, this has been Floss Weekly. I'm Doc Searles with Catherine, and we'll see you next.
Hey, we should talk Linux. It's the operating system that runs the internet, a bunch of game consoles, cell phones, and maybe even the machine on your desk. You already knew all that. What you may not know is that TwitNow has a show dedicated to it, the Untitled Linux Show. Whether you're a Linux pro, a burgeoning sysadmin, or just curious what the big deal is, you should join us on the Club Twit Discord every Saturday afternoon for news, analysis, and tips to sharpen your Linux skills. And then make sure you subscribe to the Club Twit exclusive Untitled Linux Show. Wait, you're not a Club Twit member yet? Well, go to twit.tv/clubtwit and sign up. Hope to see you there.